Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Consensus or Controversy. And tonight, we focus on the management of hepatocellular cancer and biliary tract cancers. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Katie Kelly from the Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center of the University of California in San Francisco, and Dr. Mark Yarshwin from the Johns Hopkins Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center in Washington. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. In the chat room is a one-minute pre-meeting and then later on a post-meeting survey for you to take. You'll get a lot more out of the meeting if you do that. We do webinars all the time, and on Thursday, we'll be talking about urothelial bladder cancer in our Year in Review series. So much going on there, new first-line therapy for metastatic disease. Next Wednesday, we'll be talking about prostate cancer in terms of Year in Review. So many things going on there, particularly the really fascinating EMBARK study. I want to hear what they have to say about Year in Review colorectal cancer, March the 5th. And then we'll be heading out to the SGO meeting, doing two CME symposia, but also they'll be broadcast live virtually on one on March the 18th on ovarian cancer. And later on in that day, also a program on endometrial cancer. Really great faculties. And then on March, we are going to do our general medical oncology weekend. We used to do this before the pandemic, and we're reinvigorating it now, but here in our hometown of Miami. We have a special feature on Friday night where we're not only going to talk about breast cancer, we're going to try to find some oncologists and oncology nurses who have breast cancer for us to interview prior to this meeting. If you know of anybody who might be interested, please let us know. We have 33 investigators coming to Miami. We're covering lots of different cancers, including HCC. We have Dr. Abu Alfa and Dr. Finn, so we'll hear what they have to say in that program. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars and other programs. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program we did on biliary tract cancers. Today, we're here to talk about HCC and biliary tract cancers. This is really a follow-up to the GI ASCO meeting that was held a few weeks ago, and as it is every year in San Francisco. And as always, we'll be talking about some out-of-indication uses of these agents. Please consult prescribing information. Here's the first of these webinars that we did. Actually, in the GI ASCO meeting, we did live programs on colon cancer and GE cancer, gastroesophageal. But for HCC, we actually did a webinar, and we did it the day after the GI symposium. And, of course, the day before that, the EMERALD-1 study was presented. So, you know, that was just right in our face, and we talked about it. And, of course, we're going to talk about it today. But we will refer back to what happened in the symposium initially. So as we go through this exercise today, we'll not only show you some excerpts from that webinar, but also my conversation with two other investigators, Dr. Tom Abrams from Dana-Farber and Dr. Stacy Sine from the Yale Cancer Center. Here's where we're heading. We're going to chat a little bit about sort of an overview of how HCC in particular is managed in the community-based setting. Then we'll go through some of the new data. Dr. Yarshwin will go through that. And then we'll show you some videos and talk about taking care of patients. Then Katie will go through some data, both in HCC and biliary tract cancers in terms of first-line treatment. Then we'll show you some more survey, some more videos. But I just want to start out a little bit, and we'll start with Katie, in terms of what your perception is of how HCC is being managed in the community-based setting by general medical oncologists. And I'm particularly interested in terms of how what you're seeing in terms of the support they get from interventional radiology, hepatology, and pathology. It's always been of great importance, but now EMERALD-1 and other studies coming down the line, it kind of seems like that's going to be more important than ever. And I'm really wondering, you know, what's actually going on in the community in that regard, and whether or not there's, you know, like technology support available to get efficient second opinions from these type of support services. So Katie, I know you've been very involved in many different levels of HCC. Any thoughts about what's happening in the general medical oncology, even the rural-based setting?
Yeah, I think historically HCC has been a very linear process where the patients would be managed hepatology, IR, and then transfer sort of irrevocably to oncology once the disease became advanced. And I think what we're seeing now is that this is a much more fluid interface with a lot more back and forth earlier on, especially with adjuvant data and now intermediate space data with TACE. And so I think that while in the academic setting, our multidisciplinary tumor boards are adapting pretty quickly, I am not sure yet that this linear paradigm has quite advanced yet in the community. And you're right that it is very challenging to change. There's very little multidisciplinary support in my experience, and not, you know, it's usually something that's done during people's lunch hour, during after hours. So I think it's an important thing for us to focus on. You have on the list here pathology support, and I think that's another place where we have not yet advanced. Even in our own tumor board, we don't routinely have a pathologist at our HCC tumor boards. And this is sometimes to our detriment. You know, recently I had a case Monday with a patient that was sent to me as an HCC who was actually a cholangiocarcinoma. And so I think we need to remember that pathology is increasingly important as we have more systemic therapies for both HCC and cholangio, some of which are molecularly guided.
Yeah, and at some point you can maybe comment on sort of the mixed, you know, biliary and HCC that you can see that is really confusing. I'll also encourage our chat room to contribute to this. You know, we're trying to figure out how we can help docs in general. If you have any experience with anybody, you know, kind of watching here today, you want to share with us in terms of the challenges you've faced. Mark, what's your perception of this? What do you think is going on in the community?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, Kitty and I both practice in large academic institutions, so I think, you know, we're sort of guessing when you ask us what's happening in the community. But one of the things that was an upside of the pandemic is, you know, disruption really does spawn innovation. And I think Katie and I really learned to do these second opinion video visits for a while during the pandemic. And it was really nice to see these patients that otherwise might not be able to travel to Baltimore, to UCSF. And, the things I regret is that some of these permissions to contact patients across state lines have ended. And I think that's really been a problem for patients.
I agree.
Right. And, you know, the issue about travel, though, is, you know, a lot of times you can get a lot of great information without even seeing the patient, particularly the images. And that's what I really wonder about. And we'll get into that a little bit. When I hear you all discuss the way you manage these patients, how you look at the anatomy, et cetera, the molecular status, et cetera, I really wonder, you know, what the general medical oncologist has. And again, in our symposia here in Miami, we're going to talk about that. Well, that's just a little bit, hopefully we'll get some feedback from you all. But let's talk about the content and particularly what happened at the GI ASCO meeting. And Mark, we asked you to review some of the recent data that's come out in adjuvant therapy. And of course, this really striking initial study, I imagine there are going to be a lot more looking at this, looking at intermediate stage disease, combining TACE with IO Bev. And, you know, it was interesting when I first heard about Durva Bev, I'm like, Durva Bev, you know, I kind of couldn't put it together that it's, I guess, a lot like Atezo Bev, but now we're using it earlier. In any event, Mark, let's have you go through some of these data.
Sure, yeah. Well, thanks for having me again. You know, I think as a medical oncologist, nothing is more satisfying than using the therapies that we have, not just to prolong life in advanced stage disease, but really to try to get patients to cure. And it's hard for me to think of another tumor type where we have highly effective systemic therapies that aren't routinely used to really cure patients. And if you look at the current Barcelona staging system, patients who are potentially curative, really there's no current role for systemic therapy, but this may all be about to change. We know that patients with HCC, half of them or more than half of them are likely to recur in a short amount of time. So there really is a need for highly effective perioperative therapy. You know, this is not a new idea. So many years ago, there was the STORM trial that looked at sorafenib. At the time, this was the only systemic therapy for HCC, and it really did not have any benefit in any measurable way when given after curative surgery for HCC. But fast forward, we have this new study, the I Am Brave 50 study, that randomized patients to adjuvant atezo-bev versus active surveillance. The primary endpoint was relapse-free survival. I just want to quickly point out that this study really included patients who were at high risk for recurrence. So this wasn't anybody with resected HCC. These were larger tumors, multifocal tumors, tumors with vascular invasion. Interestingly, they did not include AFP as a high-risk feature, which is interesting because I think it's one of the best validated high-risk features for recurrence. And this is the main result. So the patients who got a year of atezo-bev after surgery had about a 30% improvement in relapse-free survival versus active surveillance alone. Now, you know, the goal of adjuvant therapy is to truly cure patients. And I think, you know, this is the big discussion that all of us in this community are having. It's unclear from the data we have whether we've truly cured patients who otherwise would have relapsed or whether we've just made their scans look prettier but have just delayed a recurrence that will inevitably still happen. So, you know, are we really helping the patients by giving these therapies earlier, or are we just trading a benefit when we use the therapies later versus giving them earlier? And I think the jury's not out. You know, overall survival right now is very premature, but actually at this very early time point, there are more deaths in the group that got the adjuvant atezo-bev than the active surveillance. So, you know, I think many of us are using a more cautious approach until we have more data. So, you know, these are the major questions, I think. Will this early relapse-free survival benefit translate into eventually improved overall survival, or at least will it trend the right direction? We know a lot of these patients would be cured with surgery alone, so giving them a potentially, high-risk adjuvant therapy, you know, it's something to not a decision to take lightly. You know, do we really need the BEV? So there was no single arm component of this. So there was no single arm atezo. So we don't really know, was the BEV important? Obviously, we think that there may be some complementary or synergistic activity, but other studies should show whether PD-1 or PD-L1 alone is enough. And then could we use biomarkers to really select the group that wouldn't be cured with surgery alone and would particularly stand to benefit from this therapy? And then obviously the last challenge is we really have no high quality evidence for what to do after atezo-bev in any setting, but we certainly don't have data for what to do if patients recur after adjuvant atezo-bev. So this is an ongoing challenge in this space. So, you know, these are some of the other ongoing trials in this arena. And I think in particular, the EMERALD study will be interesting because there's a single PD-L1 arm in the study. So we'll definitively answer whether the BEV is necessary. You know, there are small single institution trials looking at neoadjuvant therapy instead of adjuvant. I think this has been something that's garnered some excitement in oncology in general. Studies of TKIs plus PD-1, trials of dual checkpoint versus single checkpoint. I think these studies in general have shown that neoadjuvant therapy is certainly feasible. You don't lose that many patients with neoadjuvant therapy to progression events. And there's about a 30% pathologic response rate, but this is not a standard approach and really needs better validation in prospective randomized trials. So, Dr. Love, I'll turn it over to you. I think you have a question here.
Right. So I just thought maybe we could ask Katie a couple of quick things. First of all, really to address Mark's question of, I don't know if you've actually seen this happen yet, Katie, patients who relapse after getting a atezo-bev, how you would think it through. And for example, this situation 18 months later as opposed to earlier. And also another thought I had as I was listening to Mark, any future role for cell-free DNA in HCC, kind of the way it's been utilized, particularly in colon cancer?
Great question. So I think for the first question shown here, you know, at 18 months, that's over a year, that's pretty long out. I think I would start a new first-line regimen, and I think I'd probably go a STRIDE regimen since the patient received adjuvant atezo-bev, though I don't think anyone could be faulted for retreating with atezo-bev. In the new era of adjuvant therapy in HCC, we need to, like other tumor types before us, define what constitutes early recurrence and second-line therapy. Like within 6 months in pancreas cancer, we call that second-line therapy, so in which case we'd probably use a TKI next. I think 18 months is beyond that threshold for me, at least. To your second question about cell-free DNA, I think AFP and cell-free DNA are definitely viable rational biomarkers. And now that we actually have adjuvant therapy, there's more of a tractable role for getting that data, I think. In the surveillance setting, I hadn't been using cell-free DNA by itself because I think I wouldn't act upon it absent a scan. But I do like the idea of looking at cell-free DNA as a decision maker for when to use adjuvant therapy in the very high risk, because I completely agree with Mark's points about right now we need a better risk stratification to pull the trigger on something that we don't have long-term survival data on yet.
So, Mark, our audience knows that I have a penchant to pick out the most exciting, interesting new trial reports of the year. Last year, I think I picked out four or five. I mentioned the EMBARK study was one of my favorites. This year, we have an early one, Emerald One. That's going to definitely be one of my favorites for 2024. So let's talk about it.
Yeah, you know, the first part of my talk was made easy because Dr. Kelly gave the same discussion just a week ago at our HCC live meeting, and I basically copied all of her talking points. So I want to give her credit. So now we're going to go to intermediate stage. So, you know, obviously systemic therapy is moving earlier. We're using it, you know, maybe cautiously in the adjuvant setting. You know, the question is, can it also move into the intermediate setting? You know, our current guidelines recommend local regional therapy alone for patients who are candidates for local regional therapy in early intermediate stage disease. A lot of trials of TACE alone that collectively show reasonable disease control and survival. And you know, obviously people have had the idea of moving systemic therapy earlier. I think the totality of the data from the TKI era is that adding TKIs early rather than waiting for patients is probably not the right strategy. We definitely increase toxicity, but it's not clear that we've really made major improvements in PFS and certainly not OS. But fast forward to January 2024, we have the results of the first true randomized immunotherapy trial on top of TACE, and this is the Emerald One study. Three-arm study randomized patients to what I would call the current standard of care, which is TACE alone. Obviously, in the United States, there may be more TARE usage, so I'll put that little caveat in. One arm got durvalumab alone, so PD-L1 antibody alone, and then durva plus bevacizumab. I think this is the first truly positive trial of this nature, and that it hit its primary endpoint of progression-free survival, specifically in the bev arm. So the addition of bevacizumab prolongs PFS, durvalumab alone does not. I think, again, this is very early data. We've hit the primary endpoint of the trial. Time to progression also looks better specifically in the BEV-containing arm. I think this is certainly encouraging, but I think we're asking many of the same questions that we ask in the early stage setting, which is, you know, obviously we've made the scans better, but have we really changed the trajectory of the cancer? Is this truly disease modifying? Or once again, are we just trading a later benefit for an early benefit? We don't have overall survival data that hasn't been presented yet. One of the notable things is there is quite a mismatch here between the time to progression and the PFS, 22 months versus 15 months. And so it raises concerns, you know, did patients have bad outcomes specifically in this doublet arm, and is that going to hurt the overall survival data? We just don't know. In terms of response rate, durvalumab did contribute to responses, even if it didn't prolong PFS, which is kind of interesting. Safety data, at least so far, looks good for the doublet arm. I think this is encouraging. But once again, if you look at the numerator, it's different for the patients who got durva-bev than the other arms, because it's only captured from the time of bevacizumab. And so, again, I think we need more data before really deciding if this is truly practice-changing. But I think it's encouraging that we have a positive readout. So, again, my key unanswered questions are not that different from the first section. You know, will this PFS benefit translate into overall survival? I think we want to at least see things trending in the right direction before deciding that this is truly practice changing, at least in my opinion. You know, this difference between PFS and time to progression, again, does raise some questions. And I think we really want to look at the data in more granularity. You know, one of the key questions also is, TACE is the current standard of care in the intermediate setting, but as systemic therapy has become more effective, it does raise questions of whether we can actually replace TACE with systemic therapy. That's happened sort of naturally. If you look at the evolution of the Barcelona staging system in 2022, the update actually suggests that patients with high burden intermediate stage disease go straight to systemic therapy. And the question is, can that evolution continue? Can some patients just get Durva-Bev or other systemic therapies? And then particularly relevant to the United States, where there's been much more adoption of Y90, can we apply this paradigm to other local regional therapies? All key unanswered questions, I would say. Just very quickly, there are a number of other intermediate setting trials going on looking at the addition of systemic therapy on top of TACE or other local therapies, and then two trials at the bottom looking to actually replace TACE. And so all these trials, I think, will be really interesting in redefining how we treat these patients. So I'm just going to end very quickly to say, I think this is a complicated and evolving space. You know, I think oncologists like to claim that whatever tumor they treat is complicated, but HCC is really complicated. I think these patients benefit from coming through a multidisciplinary clinic to really evaluate patients to decide which patients should get systemic therapy, which patients should get local regional therapy, and cautiously, which patients should get some form of the combination. I have just a couple of key trials here. There are trials showing that patients with high burden disease should get systemic therapy. We now have combination data. We have some data showing that some advanced patients perhaps may benefit from the addition of local regional therapy, particularly patients with portal vein thrombosis from the LAUNCH study, although that data is in Asia and should be applied cautiously to the West. So very complicated and evolving space is my overall conclusion here.
All right. I love this. That last graphic you showed. Let's talk a little bit. We could spend the whole hour just talking about this topic. But Katie, first of all, we asked and the initial survey we did was before GI ASCO, but we also went back to the faculty afterward to see what they thought about in terms of EMERALD-1. It looks like all the people on the faculty are thinking about it and are considering it. I think probably thinking a lot of things that Mark had just described. But Katie, what I found interesting, there was one person, actually we mentioned Dr. Abu Alpha was going to be at our program here in Miami, who's already done it. 65-year-old, no prior therapy, 7 centimeter segment 4 or 5 lesion, and 3 centimeter segment 8 lesion. What do you think about Dr. Abu Alpha's case? What kind of cases, Katie, would you be thinking about, you know, in this initial, after seeing the data early?
Yeah, I think his case makes sense. He has a large unresectable tumor in a very central part of the liver, plus a second tumor in a different portion of the liver in the right lobe in the segment 8 there. And I think with a 7 centimeter tumor, we have to presume that, you know, there's going to be residual disease after TACE. And so it makes sense to use systemic therapy. Whether you need TACE plus systemic therapy, that was Mark's question, that, you know, does this patient just need systemic therapy? That's an unanswered area right now. And I think while I completely agree with Ghassan's positioning of the EMERALD data in that patient, I think the point that I would bring up and why I answered for the proper patient as my choice in this selection criteria listing is that, you know, when we look at the forest plot from EMERALD-1, they really only stratify patients by within up to 7 criteria, meaning up to 7 tumors, you know, or 7 centimeters worth of tumor burden versus greater than up to 7. And there's a huge difference between 1 tumor, which we're eligible for the trial, and 7 tumors. And I think what I really want to see before I decide how to apply this data in my real world patients is, what about patients with 3 small tumors where we actually might be able to TACE them completely? I'm not confident that I'm going to improve their survival by starting systemic therapy earlier. I think where I'm going to apply this in patients where I'm very sure there's going to be residual disease, like the multifocal large tumors. And I think what we need to see from the EMERALD data is more stratification of the less than up to 7, meaning what about the 2, 3, 4 tumors, not 7 tumors?
So let's talk a little bit about at least how the faculty initially responded. I'll also mention in the chat room this comment from Dilip. I am an academic to community doc. Nihilism that once existed in non-small cell and prostate still exists for HCC and biliary cancers. There's limited appreciation of the plethora of targets in CCA. I hammer that in every tumor board. I also share the EMERALD-1 data, so there are challenges. And I think just the way you two are describing the way you're looking at these data, it's clear this is these are not simple issues here. Here's a little bit more of in terms of the faculty for the first program, their initial reaction 24 hours after they saw the data. Let's talk about EMERALD-1 that just got presented yesterday.
Yeah, so yes, this is very significant news, Neil, for two reasons. One is it is a validation of this concept of anti-VEGF and checkpoint inhibitors in HCC in a different stage. So we already have approval with atezolizumab for advanced stage disease. This is intermediate stage disease. So it's a validation of the same concept in HCC, which is great. Number two, it also fulfills an unmet need for this population, especially those patients who have multifocal disease and they have to go through multiple rounds of tests.
So aren't curious about your thoughts about this strategy. And do you think that people are going to be thinking about, you know, this strategy for everybody who gets tests?
I think it's a very good question. And I mean, first of all, I agree with Ahmed. It's a very interesting study. It's really something about the BEV that adds efficacy here. We know that there are some TACE eligible candidates that have multiple tumors, larger tumors, not the perfect candidates for TACE. I think they should get it. The other point, when you look at the subgroup analyses, there was not really a subgroup that suggested that a specific group would not benefit. So, I mean, this will require a lot of discussion also in the tumor board. Who will get it? It's not a clear picture that somebody does not need to get it, to be honest. If at all, the subgroups were very small. I think this is something we really need to look in a little bit more detail and get some more data.
So it's just so fascinating for us out there in the real world to see you all, you know, deal with new data as it comes out. Katie, any thoughts about what you just heard?
Yeah, I think I agree with both points and, you know, reiterate that we don't yet know that the patients with just a few small tumors benefit. If we can do complete TACE treatment, I'm not confident that I'll use this regimen yet.
So, Mark, I'd like you to listen to the next thought that came out in the webinar. It was interesting because we had done a program the night before in colon cancer, and they presented a patient with MSI-high disease who got an IO, a metastatic, got an IO, and then after one dose got pneumonitis. And that got me thinking about, well, if you're given, and Mark, you've said you've actually done this strategy already, even prior to the EMERALD coming out. And I wondered, like, is there an issue of trying to figure out, like, say you have embolization syndrome or is it going to be hard to, what's going to be involved with having the two on board? Here's what Ahmed said when I brought this up.
Now you have a patient who just underwent the first TACE, and then after that, shortly after, you're starting immunotherapy. And especially for those patients with multifocal disease or large tumors, they could suffer post-embolization syndrome. And with the emergence of immunotherapy, now we've been using it for 6 years in HCC, we've learned a lot about the correlation between adverse events and underlying liver disease and cirrhosis. And this study allowed B7 patients, so patients who are early child PUB. So we really need to know more about the adverse events that they encountered, especially in the first 3 to 4 months, where, you know, you see a lot of events on the curve. So once we get to learn more about the tolerance, quality of life, it's going to help us apply it to practice.
So Mark, you're at Hopkins, Checkpoint Central. Some people view it as, incidentally, I hope you recovered from the Ravens game. I'm actually from Baltimore and I still haven't recovered. Anyhow, any thoughts about this? You were mentioning before we got started, you've actually done this even before EMERALD, I guess, bringing in an IO or what about this issue of figuring out what's from the TACE and what's from the IO? Is that an issue or not really?
I mean, I think it's hard to make a general statement here. For me, post-embolization syndrome involves mostly fevers and feeling really lousy. And so I think in general, true IREs from checkpoint inhibitors, you know, have a different feel, a different phenotype. We don't tend to see fevers. We don't tend to see just profound fatigue. So I'm not so worried about that. But, you know, again, I think I totally agree with Ahmed's point that, you know, we really need granularity in the safety data. The data that's been presented, as I think I alluded to this in my talk, was only for the patients who got a dose of Bev. You know, we only see the data for the 154 patients. So it's very hard to compare across all three arms because the numerator is quite different for the combo arm. And so, I think, at least for me, I want to see a little more data before making any strong judgments here.
All right, well, let's move on to a question we have been debating for a while. And just, you know, as time goes on, we get more input in how people are managing the question of first-line therapy of advanced HCC. Here are some thoughts both from our from Dr. Stein and Abrams, but also Dr. Vogel.
You know, the gold standard right now is that every patient be treated first-line with an immune therapy combination. Atezo-Bev, you know, has been the gold standard a few years. Then we have Durva-Tremi with the STRIDE regimen. And, you know, it's always interesting to hear from people in different places how easy it is to get an upper endoscopy. A lot of the questions that often come up are which regimen to use. The risk of adverse immune-related events requiring high-dose steroid use was about 20% with Durva-Tremi, which is not insignificant. And it is lower, you know, with Atezo-Bev.
My feeling is that the necessity for an EGD kind of makes it a little bit easier to start Durva-Tremi. I think in general, the fact that you're getting combined checkpoint inhibition for one dose only, and then the rest of it is just a PD-L1 inhibitor, I think that's attractive as well. You know, Bev has its own set of issues associated with it. And also the 4-year survival data for Durva-Tremi seems pretty interesting.
The good thing is we have options now, right? And we can look more closely to our patient and we can base our decision-making on the patient profile. Yeah, it's not only contraindications against IO, and I agree that with STRIDE, we do have more IO-related side effects, which we also do see in the clinic, but we also have contraindications against Bev. I agree a little bit with Stacy that the majority of patients at the moment still get Atezo-Bev. We have more experience with that. But I also agree that Durva-Tremi is a very interesting option. The long-term survival data are very compelling. So definitely two very valid treatment options.
So, Katie, I'm curious about your thoughts about this. I've talked to you about this in the past. Also, just to mention, I guess in Emerald-1, they also required endoscopy because they're given the Bev. Any thoughts about where you are today with this choice? And also, and we're going to take a look at the longer-term follow-up data from these two studies.
Yeah, I think both, I double down on what Arndt said, which is that it's great to have options so that we can tailor our choice to individual patients, largely based on comorbidities right now. Unfortunately, we still don't have a predictive biomarker for efficacy, but I do make the decision based on patients' comorbidity profiles. If all else is equal and two perfectly fit patients, I'll discuss the data in as great a detail as we can and talk. I do talk about the 4-year survival data and the fact that when we get a response with the STRIDE regimen, we feel very comfortable that it's an immune response, meaning both components of the regimen are immune checkpoint inhibitors, and we have very strong data about the durability of those responses. I'm not as confident that all responses on Atezo-Bev are true immune responses. I think some of them are more transient Bev responses based on a shorter duration of response median.
So, Mark, again, this has been discussed a lot. I'm curious where you stand on it. And also, you know, a lot of docs out there have had experience with Ipi-Nivo, but not so many with Durva-Tremi, and maybe compare the two indirectly in terms of the need for corticosteroids for immune complications. And how are you making this decision nowadays?
You know, I really agree with everything that Katie said. I mean, I think it's wonderful to have options for patients. You know, when I started treating HCC, we had one drug. It was sorafenib, prolonged life by 3 months, maybe less, and was pretty miserable. So just the fact that we have two reasonable frontline options is exciting. You know, I think between Durva-Tremi and Ipi-Nivo, obviously we haven't compared them head-to-head in any way, but, you know, if you look at the totality of the data, I think the perception is that the toxicity is probably lower with Durva-Tremi than it is with Ipi-Nivo. just in terms of steroid use. You know, more than half of patients with ipi-nivo in the phase 2 study had, you know, severe adverse events and required steroids. You know, that said, I think the effective anti-CTLA-4 dose for ipi-nivo is probably higher, and with more toxicity might come a higher response rate. In the phase 2, it was over 30% compared to 20% for durva-tremi. So, you know, it's not that one regimen's better than the other. I think we have a first-line regimen, and then we have a second-line regimen in ipi-nivo. And I do sometimes use ipi-nivo as a second-line regimen, even in the contemporary era. We're all anxiously awaiting the first-line ipi-nivo data, and we'll probably be able to say more.
So I'm curious about second-line durva-tremi as a possibility as well. Katie, why don't you listen to some comments in terms of second-line therapy, also the child PUC patient.
Let's say a patient did very well with atezo-bev, you know, was on it for a long period of time, and then either had some mild progression of disease or was unable to continue Bev, would you consider switching to durva-tremi rather than moving to a TKI such as, you know, lenvatinib? And if so, who are the patients that you would consider that for?
Any other questions?
We know what we can give in child A. We kind of have some data in child B, but we do see a fair amount of patients who are actually they actually have very good performance status, but they, by the parameters, they're child C, and we want to treat them. You know, what do you do in those situations? Let's say they have a bili of, you know, 6, and they've had some encephalopathy, but it's well controlled now, and they come out to have, you know, 11 points, but in actuality, you kind of think they're not that bad. What do you do? Because I myself, I've treated patients like this, and I've had some patients who've done well with immunotherapy, you know, nivo alone, and that's typically what I'll do. But I'd like to hear the faculty's opinion on that.
Katie?
Yeah, so to the first question, using durva-tremi as a straight second-line option, you know, I think regulatory or insurance approval aside, I do tend to use a TKI in the second line just under the premise that if immune checkpoint inhibitor combination up front wasn't working, you know, it makes more sense to try a multi-kinase inhibitor. I think I have used durva-tremi as a third line, and I potentially would in as a second line if someone has a contraindication or a strong aversion or intolerance to a TKI. That I have actually just done that for someone who didn't tolerate lenvatinib, and so we went to durva-tremi because of concern about toxicity and trying to balance a slightly lower risk but adding a CTLA-4 inhibitor. So yes, I've done it, though again, we don't have data in that setting for durva-tremi. To Tom's other question about child PUC, I completely agree that there are patients that waffle between a B9 and a C10 just based on an albumin value or exactly how we score their encephalopathy, and some of them are pretty stable. So in a patient that has very stable function and seems like a candidate for therapy, I have tended to use durvalumab based on the durvalumab non-inferiority to sorafenib data in the Himalaya trial. It is a very difficult population, and I don't see that we would ever be successful in prospectively studying this population because they're so heterogeneous, and some patients are on a very downward trajectory and not stable for treatment. But in a patient who's stable for treatment based on our clinical gestalt, I would use durvalumab.
So we asked Katie to review a number of data sets related to first-line therapy tolerability with HCC and biliary tract. Before she gets into that, though, Mark, quick question from Dr. Kumar from the Florida Cancer Specialist in the chat room. As a patient with a 12x16 HCC, gave atezo-bev, I guess, neoadjuvantly, good response down to 8x0.3x6, planning surgery. So neoadjuvant and then surgery. What would you do post-op, Mark?
Well, we have no data. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that there's a right answer. You know, we're sort of extrapolating from other tumor types here. I think most of the benefit of the checkpoint has already been captured, but I don't think it'd be wrong to continue the therapy adjuvantly for a year. We just don't have data
see breast cancer, checkmate 522. Katie, actually, what I thought we could do is just chat about these slides, you know, rather than do it as a formal presentation, just get your take about it, particularly because we know a lot of people end up listening to our programs. So first, we were talking about longer follow-up now with Himalaya, with a 36-month survival data with 30% with the STRIDE regimen. Any comments on that? Is it 3-year survival, 30% seems pretty high.
Yeah, so on the prior slide with the 36-month data with the initial publication, we can see that the STRIDE arm in the teal color is really separating the most from sorafenib with time, which sort of reinforces that the tremelimumab is either augmenting the durva or that we're capturing an additional couple percent of patients on top of durvalumab with true immune, deep, durable responses where we see that flat, nice end of the curve in a much higher proportion of patients. And then on your next slide, the table shown there, we see what pretty unprecedented data in HCC, at least, to show actual mature four-year survival data with over 48 months of follow-up. So 49 months of follow-up in the STRIDE arm. This was presented by Bruno Sangro at World GI ESMO this past June in 2023. By comparison, we don't actually have the follow-up data from IMbrave 150 because it was closed, stopped early after interim, and there wasn't a long-term follow-up amendment unlike the Himalaya trial. And so we see the median survival is 19 months versus 13.4 months. But that's only with about 17 months of follow-up at the Cheng publication shown here. And so we don't really know how these are quite as durable. And as I mentioned earlier, we presume that the atezolizumab is, as an immune checkpoint inhibitor, giving us a really durable response. What I don't know is that I suspect that a subset of patients are getting BEV responses that may not truly be immune responses, since we know BEV alone has about a 10% response rate. And so I don't know that all of the patients that are responders on atezo-BEV are true immune responders. And we just don't have the long-term data to tell us that.
So before we go on, Mark Adley in the chat room, I guess hearing about atezolizumab brings up the issue of anti-drug antibodies and whether that's a real phenomenon or clinical issue. Mark, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this was a sort of surprise to some of us when the FDA label came out that there was a post-hoc subgroup analysis that, you know, patients had a good percent of them had ADAs, and the patients who had ADAs seemed to not benefit more from atezo-bev than from sorafenib. And then there was a follow-up cohort study that showed that, again, a high percent of patients, double-digit percentage, have ADAs, and again, those patients did worse. You know, it's hard to know what to make of this. I you don't know, is there something about the patients who make ADAs that also do badly from a cancer perspective? Are they just really inflamed and that's why they have lots of antibodies and that's why they do badly? Or is it truly that these are drug inactivating antibodies and you lose the efficacy of the drug? We just don't know. You know, I think at the end of the day, you have no idea who's making ADAs because it's not a clinical test. So I think we just look at the overall survival and we just have to assume that maybe some patients have ADAs. We don't know who they are.
So let's get back to Katie's slides. And again, I just really want you to give us the top line, Katie, and people can go as they know and take a look at your slides. You have a lot of great detail. I'm going to flip through them, but I just want to kind of get your overall take. So really what we want to do is get you to compare in your own mind, not just the data, the tolerability safety profiles of the two first-line regimens that we've been discussing, both with HCC and then now transitioning over to biliary. So let's talk about HCC and the IMbrave and Himalaya study. Any significant differences in the patients who went into the study, Katie?
Yeah, both were about 40% Asian. Both were pretty high-risk population based on AFP greater than 440%. I think the IMbrave 150 trial did have a higher proportion of macrovessel invasion of almost 40%, noting that this trial did not, the IMbrave 150 did not exclude main portal vein tumor thrombus, unlike Himalaya and other trials recently like LiPo2, which did, but otherwise pretty similar.
How about the safety profile? Again, we were talking about, you know, autoimmune complications, particularly.
Yeah, so I think the IMbrave 150, you know, if you want to fast forward a couple slides, I have a summary, I think, that showed just the high level So these are just looking at really on high, the all-cause events. And we can see that we have a little bit higher serious adverse events and grade 3-4 events related to anti-angiogenic therapy, in particular bleeding and thrombosis, which are a big deal in the clinic with anti-angiogenic therapy. But if you look at immune-related adverse events requiring steroids, as Stacy mentioned earlier, that was 20% in Durva-Tremi, not reported in IMbrave150, but we expect it to be less than 10% for a drug like Atezo as monotherapy. So I think those are the two high-level differences that we see, a little bit higher rates of grade 3-4 overall and SAE overall with Atezo-Bev, but higher rates of immune-related adverse events as expected with Durva-Tremi. And then I think as a clinician, the events I really care about are, you know, I think that are meaningful are when do we have to stop our treatment because of an adverse event? That's actually a little higher in Atezo-Bev.
Anything you want to add to this slide where you go through a lot of issues, but maybe you can kind of summarize the key issues that you think about in considering both of these regimens.
Yeah, so I think the first bullet, the bolded points here are just that in a fit patient with no major comorbidities, I tend to discuss both regimens. I do am swung and compelled by the data from the 4-year survival endpoint landmark of Himalaya that these are true deep durable immune responses. So I think that is really impactful data. But I think both Atezo-Bev and Himalaya and STRIDE regimen are very reasonable and a very fit first line patient. In patients who have any worrisome vascular comorbidities, and that includes people with a TIA, carotid atherosclerosis, any kind of clots or anticoagulation, and of course patients with varices, I use STRIDE. And I am very quick to do that because I'm very worried about high-risk complications that require us to stop treatment or be life-altering, especially elderly, poorly controlled diabetic type patients. In patients who have a higher risk of autoimmune complications, like patients maybe who are kind of borderline for immunotherapy, like prior history of Crohn's or inflammatory bowel disease that's well controlled, where I'm nervous about immune checkpoint inhibitors, I use Atezo-Bev. And I also think Atezo-Bev is a better choice in someone who has really bulky, rapidly progressive disease with just one shot on goal. Like if it's someone who I think if this doesn't work, this is show's over, I tend to use Atezo-Bev if they're eligible for it because it does have a better PFS, and the anti-angiogenic therapy, whether it's synergistic or not, it slows the disease down in the higher proportion of patients. And then I tend to use durvalumab, as I mentioned, in the really borderline liver function, in the more borderline patients who I'm not confident are good for system combination therapy. And then lenvatinib in patients who are not immune checkpoint inhibitor candidates. And occasionally for a patient who has really low burden metastatic disease, like slow growing small lung mets, and they're still working and they live far away and they don't want to come in every 3 or 4 weeks for infusions, but they don't have local regional options because it's maybe, again, like I said, maybe multifocal, but small lung mets, I might use lenvatinib.
So, Mark, anything about what Katie just said that you kind of do differently?
You know, our practices are surprisingly close here, I think. You know, I really second something that Katie said, which is, you know, if you only have one shot on goal, again, you know, we're stuck with cross-trial comparisons. Everyone says don't do cross-trial comparisons, but you have two regimens. They've never been compared head-to-head. You know, Atezo-Bev does have, I think, numerically a better PFS and a better response rate. So if you need a response and you have one shot on goal and this patient's unlikely to reach a second-line therapy, I think Atezo-Bev is probably the better regimen. You know, for a patient who has low-volume disease, who's going to hit many lines of therapy, but if they respond, that response is going to be transformative, you know, and you're really going for maybe they'll be the lucky patient with a complete response, you know, going for the tail of the curve, knowing that you've got a second line option if they don't respond. I think STRIDE is great. It's great to have options.
Be great to have more follow-up as well. Let's just briefly get in. I'm going to get your reaction to some of the videos we have, but just to take a finish out in terms of the data, Katie. In terms of first-line therapy for biliary tract cancer, of course, obviously we have TOPAZ-1 with durvalumab, Keynote with Pembro. Without going through the slides, can you just sort of bottom line your global view on kind of the difference between those two and, you know, putting reimbursement aside, whether or not you have any preference one way or the other?
I think both the Keynote 966 with Pembro and the Topaz 1 with Durva combined with GemSys, the take-home message from the safety perspective is safety is very similar to GemSys alone, with a pretty small rate of immune-related toxicity that we expect from an immune checkpoint inhibitor as monotherapy. And we can see that represented by the rate of systemic corticosteroid use, which is only 9% in the Pembro GemSys context. So I think they're very equivalent with safety-wise, and the high frequency events are due to the GemSys steroid rate less than 10% for both.
So let's take a look at some of the findings from the survey. I will tell you that in the appendix, you find like a ton of survey results. So if you're interested in what people are doing in practice, we have survey questions also on targeted therapy, which it really isn't a topic, but we wanted to ask them anyhow. So there's a ton of stuff in here. Here's just a little bit of a tasting menu. So, Mark, we asked the faculty in general, you have a younger patient, good liver function. What's their first-line therapy? And it's a little bit split. You have a couple of people preferring Durva/Tremi, including the PI. And then you have Katie, who seems on the fence, and others, Tezo/Bev. But interestingly, when you sort of flip it out and now make the patient 78, Child PUB7, a PS1, a couple of people, including you, Mark, flip over to Durva/Tremi. How come?
I think in this case, again, you know, I might flip back if I saw the scans. We don't have complete data here, but I think Child PUB7 makes me a little more worried about bleeding. I think an immunotherapy alone regimen might make more sense there.
So this is what we were talking about before in terms of the potential of bringing in a regimen with an anti-CTLA-4, whether it's ipi/nivo or Durva/Tremi in a patient with prior Atezo/Bev. And it looks like almost all the faculty do that or consider it as well. We asked people to tell us about the last... Go ahead.
Really quickly,
dude, we got to get through.
we have a small retrospective study. We pooled our data with UT Southwestern looking at ipi/nivo post Atezo/Bev or other PD-1 containing frontline regimens. And we showed a 22% response rate to ipi/nivo in a subsequent line. So there is some data for this. I use more ipi/nivo in this context than Durva/Tremi because there may be something about switching from a PD-L1 to a PD-1 antibody. I don't know.
That's interesting thought. We asked people, getting back to first-line therapy here, we asked the people to tell us about the last patient where they use Durva chemo. And you see the age, interesting. One case there, 34 years old. People generally use the Topaz-1 regimen, and you can see kind of what happened with these patients. When we ask in general how people think through first and second line therapy, it looks like most people think about Durva/Tremi, but Katie says Pembro, Cis/Gem. Katie, what are you thinking there?
I have equipoise between the two regimens. I think Durva/Gemsys and Pembro/Gemsys are very equivalent in terms of their efficacy. Our institution has a more favorable contract for pembrolizumab, I guess.
Well, that's interesting. So, yeah, maybe we'll change your answer to the same as Mark, which seems like kind of a coin flip. Anyhow, yep. Let's get back and finish out here with some clinical pearls or from you all in terms of taking care of patients. First, again, getting back to the issue of first-line therapy of biliary tract cancer, here are some of the thoughts that came out in the prior meeting.
When you have similar data between two regimens, the one that is approved first and published first often kind of becomes the standard, right? So I think most people have a lot of familiarity with giving Cis/Gem and Durva, although there is the Pembro data. So that's in the Keynote 966 study. I think the question really is there any reason to kind of choose the Pembro regimen over the durvalumab regimen?
Is there?
Not as far as I could tell.
We have now options. Is it Durva/Tremi or Atezo/Bev? In colon cancer, we are talking about FOLFOX/FOLFIRI, right? These are different drugs, right? But outcome is very, very similar. And for decision-making, we don't have any biomarker who would suggest that either drug is more effective than the other. So both are very valid options.
Any other issues that come up in this situation?
One of the big questions that comes up is the patients who have external dwelling catheters, they're at such high risk for infection. It's virtually guaranteed that they're going to get some cholangitis at some point. How do you manage it when patients are on chemotherapy, which certainly escalates the risk? What do you do for patients who have repeated episodes of cholangitis? Do you ever consider stopping chemotherapy because of it? And what else do you do for it?
Mark, any comments, particularly the issue of patients with catheters?
It's just a tough situation. There's no way to win there. I don't know. Katie may have something to say.
I just add that I've sometimes continued the Durva or the Pembro while treating an infection, which is a nice way to at least try to keep them, maintain some of the systemic therapy, hold the gem cyst, but continue the Durva for the couple of weeks that the patient's on antibiotics.
That's interesting. Let me let you listen to another comment that came out that kind of was off my radar, but I think actually is very relevant. I'm curious what your thoughts are. Here are some other comments.
Not everyone's going to handle the chemotherapy well. I think in particular, the way that gem cyst is delivered can be challenging for patients. Days 1 and 8 is not very easy. And so for my elderly patients, I almost always will start with a dose modification and see if they can tolerate it and then move up if needed. Because when it was just gem cyst, if you were elderly, I almost always started you on days 1 and 15. I sort of, you know, stretched it out. And I thought that that was much more tolerable. And it didn't seem to have any effect on outcomes. But with the Durva being in there, it's harder to do that because you give it every 21 days. Although I think it's not unreasonable to give Durva every 28 days either. But I haven't been doing that. So I think it can be a fairly toxic regimen.
Any thoughts, Ahmed?
So I do the same exact thing, which is day 1 and 15 of gem cyst modified dose. And I do Durva every 4 weeks. And this is because I see a lot of HCC patients. I'm very comfortable with Durva every 4 weeks. So this is my strategy for all patients, to be honest, not only elderly, because very few patients can handle the gem 1,000 milligram per meter squared day 1 and 8. Even in the study itself, a lot of patients had to have dose reduction.
Mark, any thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Maybe people in Baltimore are just a little tougher, but I managed to stick to the regimen for many patients and just give, you know, small dose reductions in some patients. I'm not routinely switching to a day 1-15 sort of regimen, although I don't think there's anything wrong with doing that.
You didn't realize that Baltimore is actually pronounced Baltimore? And Katie, what about you? What kind of chemo do you want to use, or what do you think about Tom's comments?
I agree with Mark that a lot of my patients do just, even older patients, do just fine with day 1, day 8, every 21 days. But patients who have toxicity and early intractable cytopenias, I'll do the day 1, day 15, every 28 days as well. But it's not a huge problem.
So a few things are coming up in the chat room. I want to come back to Mark. Thuy has a patient with a very large gallbladder carcinoma, no nodal involvement per EUS. Not a surgical candidate. How would you think through therapy for a patient like that? Would you offer gem cyst, Durva, FOLFOX, chemo, or XRT?
Yeah, you know, these are great cases for a large tumor board. I think the first question I would ask my surgeon is this ever resectable? Like, if we got a good response, could this come out? If so, you know, I think gem cyst Durva, gem cyst Pembro is reasonable. You know, another thing to consider would actually be gem cyst Abraxane. Now, I just want to mention this is a negative phase 3 study in terms of overall survival. So we're not routinely using gem cyst Abraxane, but it did have a numerically high response rate. And in subgroup analysis, the locally advanced group did quite well with it. So in select cases, I might even do gem cyst Abraxane to try to get them to surgery. If they're never resectable, gem cyst Durva, gem cyst Pembro, and probably consolidate with radiation.
So you owe us $15 for saying Abraxane 3 times. But, you know, we saw a paper the other day for GE cancer. It was amazing, Katie, where they compared nab-paclitaxel plus an IO to paclitaxel plus an IO to no IO. And they actually saw considerably better efficacy with the nab than the paclitaxel, presumably because they don't use corticosteroids related to nausea and vomiting. And most of the stuff we've heard about corticosteroids and the effect of IOs has been when you use corticosteroids for immune issues. But this is a question of, you know, we can't not use it if you're going to use an emetic drug, but are we, in, you know, reducing the impact with corticosteroids? Any thoughts, Katie?
That's a great question because, you know, I think we don't see quite as much efficacy as we'd like with respect to improving response rate with the addition of Durva or Pembro, and I don't think we have a complete answer to that. So it is really interesting to see the precedent from other tumor types. That that said, I do think that low-dose cisplatin doesn't always require very much steroid, and so it does suggest that perhaps we should be trying to taper people back a little bit more than we currently do.
All right. I'm struck between showing them one more video and a great question in the chat room that I actually have had myself. So I think I'll bring this one up, Mark, particularly because you're at the Checkpoint Central there in Hopkins. What about the MOED calls it biphenotypic hepatocellular cancer and intrahepatic cholangio. I call it a case where you can't figure out whether it's a HCC or a biliary tract. Mode wants to know what's first line treatment in that situation.
There are studies going on of gem cis checkpoint bev, which is kind of the best of all worlds because you're throwing our most effective regimens for both. But off of a trial, you know, I think we sort of alternate between HCC and cholangio regimens. I personally would start with gem cis checkpoint and then switch to maybe a lenvatinib in second line. That would be my preference. The other thing is the biphenotypics often do have actionable driver mutations. We've seen some IDH1s, FGFR2s, so definitely worth sequencing these patients as you would for any cholangio.
Final comment on this challenging situation, Katie?
I agree completely with Mark. I use GemCis checkpoint, and I do always sequence them.
You're not allowed to agree so much, but I'm just kidding. I'm glad you all agree. You all talk all the time, so I'm not surprised you agree. But thank you so much, Katie and Mark, for chatting with us tonight, particularly these new data that just came out. Audience, thank you for attending. Coming back on Thursday night, how about IO plus antibody drug conjugate as first-line therapy in metastatic disease? A lot better than platinum-based chemotherapy, incidentally. So, of course, we're talking about enfortumab and pembrolizumab on Thursday and a lot of other stuff. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Katie. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Neil.